Steve.
That's too bad for them.
So, I don't know how many other people there are.
Maybe they'll come back. They'll wind up and come back. So maybe they'll send friends.
Steve will come back.
I think he will.
I
don't think he's coming back.
He doesn't know?
Yeah. Steve said he'd come back in a couple of weeks.
You never know. I left Asha Tara 10 years ago.
You should go back to Asha Tara?
No, why?
Okay, so.
I was going to go back to Asha Tara. Yeah, I was there for a month. I was traveling and I stumbled upon something interesting. I didn't quite know why. So it took me a little while to figure out why. And I'm still not doing it.
Isn't that part of being a wandering Jew?
Okay.
So you're restless.
Do you have some essays still?
Yes.
There's another one. The next page.
Is there a book that we come from that we can get, or is it the Maharal?
Maharal.
We have a collection of the...
there's one there. I mean, they usually, I don't know if they sell individual volumes of it. They probably do. But,
how can you tell them apart? Do they have a volume marking? Or
yeah, it says which one on the back what it is.
I just bought these other books as well.
Yeah.
Which one is it?
It's called Derech Haim.
So there's different Derech Haims, or that's the
other? Derech Haim, yes. Many Sfarim are named Derech Haim, but this is the only Derech Haim written by the Maharal.
Is this available?
Oh, okay.
Huh?
Is this available in English?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. It may be, because I don't know everything, but I don't think so. Okay, so let's take a look back in the Siddur first. So the Siddur, on page 582,
do
I have to close? No, it's fine. You can leave it open. I don't mind either way.
No, it's fine. We'll pick up some parts.
Okay. So we actually got yesterday to, in Maharal, we were doing Miut Chora, and what did we get up to? We did we're in the middle of doing we did Miut Tainu. We did all those three. Limited business activity, limited sexual activity, limited pleasure. That's what we got up to. And now we're on page 584, actually. And the next one here is Miut Sicha. But the Maharal... Was he of Miut Sicha next? I don't think so. What is he of next? Next one here is Miut Chok. He's going out of order here. So he doesn't have... Let's just look at the Maharal. So I need a way to do it. Anyway, the Maharal, page Reshchet Tzadik. That's the Hebrew letters written on this page in order, the Resh Tzadik Chet. But Resh Tzadik Chet is the word for murder. So therefore, many Sfarim, when they come to page Resh Tzadik Chet, they turn around to Reshchet Tzadik. The same thing, if you get to page Resh Ayin Hey, which spells Ra'ah, so they'll change it to Ora, or Resh Ayin, 270, which is Ra, they'll change it to Ayin Resh. There are a whole bunch of places like that. I think maybe that's it, but the page number is negative connotation that they turn it around, so it shouldn't think about those things.
Just to confuse the situation.
Right, yeah. So we are on page Resh Ches Tzadi, which is page 208 plus 90, and we're doing Giyot Tainug yesterday. So let's take up from there. We're in the middle of that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, in the second column. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. 14 lines down. The last word in the line is V-H. There's a period and then the word V-H. The Yesh asks this one, going to ask the question. The Mashma, it seems from the Mishnah, Dafka Miut Tainu, it specifically means you're supposed to have diminished pleasure. Avo Tainu Ba'ama Mutter, but not no pleasure. And there are certain pleasures which are permitted. We said in a prior Mishnah, Kach Dakar Shofer, this is the way you are involved in Torah. Pasma Shofer, you eat bread with salt, etc. So it seems that no pleasures are permitted. Beis Akasha, says Maral, it's not difficult. Cloud, at all. Shekhlad be Arno, because we already explained, Shein HaPirusha, Tzorek Lano, it's not so. Because the understanding is not that a person has to afflict the soul. There's no positive value in afflicting oneself, in imposing suffering on oneself. Shalomu, Shatora Miskayim, Bemisha Memisatora Torah, Ratsu Osa Bishalor Torah. That which the rabbis say, that you don't find the Torah being sustained unless somebody's willing to kill himself over Torah, not kill himself literally, but rather, you know, cause himself suffering, that's only if it's necessary for him to learn Torah. But if it's not necessary, that's if he can only learn if he restricts himself to bread and salt. The cause is bar malo, and the other things that you mentioned, drinking water, lying on the ground. Then he has to do it because he has to learn. But if he can afford to learn and sleep on a nice bed and eat good food and drink good wine, so lo amu, they didn't say you have to specifically look for suffering. It's not required. Of course, a person shouldn't be excessive. That's what I'm saying, meal tainuk. You have to diminish your pleasures, but not no tainuk, no pleasure whatsoever. And that's what he says, when we come, nevertheless, tainuk yoisemi dai, too much pleasure, ayasa, that he shouldn't do, mishum shu noise bezeh, because he inclines himself that way, el tavos hagufnios, to bodily desires. Which is the opposite of Torah. In other words, Torah is supposed to, when it's supposed to have a type of desire, a drive to learn Torah. But if you get involved in pleasure, then you have a drive, a desire to get involved, more involved in pleasure. So it's either or. They don't go together.
Now, food is the most elementary pleasure, I would imagine, that we all have in common.
I would say so, yeah.
So we die. It's almost a need, which is why the mitzvah of the bracha has a huge discrepancy between whether you intended to eat this or eat that, and I just ate it because of an impulse, or I was actually planning to eat it, and I'm hungry for it, so therefore I don't need to say, I need to say a blessing, but the blessing on water, you know, the difference between being thirsty and needing it,
mm-hmm.
is still something that I'm kind of bouncing back and forth on. The concept of when you should be more thankful, although you may need to say a bracha, part of the purpose of the bracha is when you feel that you need it rather than you desire it.
I don't think that's an accurate description. In terms of water, you always make a bracha on water, whether you need it or whether you want it, unless you're drinking it for some other reason which is more functional, such as you have to swallow a pill, or your mouth is dry. So in that case, if you're not drinking the water because you want the water, but rather for some other purpose, so then you don't make the bracha.
So the leniency is a lot less.
Yeah, it's very rare. I mean, except you always swallow a pill. That's the most prevalent example, because then you're not swallowing the water in order to drink water, but rather just to get the pill to go down.
So in line with that thought, that the pleasure we're talking about now is food and drink, okay? If you think about other pleasures that maybe we are encouraged to abstain from in various ways to a greater degree because they're not required for immediate health and sustenance. Those pleasures, how do we make a decision in those cases without being too specific on the actual issue?
The decision about what, for example?
Physical pleasures with intimacy and pleasures within friendships. So when do you cross the line? When do you...
Each person's different. It's a hard thing to know. There's no objective standard.
So there's no monorail on that topic?
No. For some people, it's necessary to have their personalities require, you know, more comfortable conditions. Other people don't require comfortable conditions. Some people, you know, in order for them to function, they need to have delicacies. Some people, they have no need for delicacies.
But that's not actually regulated.
No, there's no specific regulation for that.
What would be the last frontier on that topic? Nida?
Why is that the last frontier? I don't
know.
I'm
thinking in terms of
space is the last frontier.
Place, of course, but then there's the written Torah, there's the oral Torah, right?
Right.
And the oral Torah is more discussed within the commentaries, so you meet your rabbi, and if it gets to an issue that you can't seem to find because you don't know where to look for it, or because it's not available, or for whatever other reason, you go with the oral Torah of who you're closest to, hoping that you've done everything you can to find out.
Not accurate.
Not accurate either.
No.
Okay.
A person's supposed to consult with a rav or consult with books which tell him what to do, in terms of the legal aspects of a person's self. terms of what a person should be doing halakhically. When it comes to what a person, and even in terms of what a person should believe theologically, but when it comes to a person's behavior and conduct in areas which are kind of optional, so then, unless somebody knows you very, very well, he won't be able to give you advice, because it's not one size fits all. So therefore, you really have to either, you know, disclose everything and have a long conversation with somebody before you can become your mentor, or you have to figure things out on your own.
Well, we know that.
Let's say, you know,
that hasn't produced the best results in the past.
Okay, but that's true, but that's a process of maturity. I mean, sometimes people can tell you, but usually throughout your life it's not going to be that way. I mean, look, there's a pillow here in class. So let's say some people can sleep with no pillows, right? Some people need three pillows to sleep. So what's the rabbi going to tell you? Only one pillow, right? What do you mean? I can't sleep with only one pillow. It's not comfortable enough. So how is that a rabbinical decision?
Well, I think that my real question then, and since we're going in this direction, is...
Stick to the pillows.
How can we find out where the commentaries are and where they aren't? So when you talk about these optional areas, where are the optional areas? How can we find out what is optional so that we can...
Are you looking for parameter, basically?
Sure.
Almost everything we do is an optional activity.
Even a mitzvah?
No. But most, even mitzvahs are optional to if they're not required. Depends. If certain mitzvahs are required.
So if every time I'm in a situation and I feel like I need to make a halakhic decision, should I run through the 613 mitzvahs and say, that's an idea, okay, now I can be optional?
Yeah, preferably.
You could tell a lot of...
Yeah, you could do that, right? So it just goes there. But the 613 don't encompass everything because you have all the rabbinic requirements.
I think
but listen, this much we can say. Whatever halacha says, halacha can tell an individual how much pleasure he needs in order to function at a baseline.
When does pleasure become sin?
When it becomes sin?
Right.
It doesn't become sin unless that's a Christian view. There's no inherent problem with pleasure in Judaism. And even if you do things in excess, it's still not a sin. It's a bad trait. We're looking for traits which are refined for people to be gluttons, right?
Right.
It's not a sin. There's no sin of gluttony.
There's no such sin of being oppressive.
No, there's no sin of being oppressive.
Maybe an avera would be a bad sin?
No. It's a bad mito. It's a bad trait.
So you want, I mean, when we are judged, so to speak, we talk about the atonement for Yom Kippur and the Hashem will Alam Abba, the level at which we will appreciate the world to come, that will be correlated, there will be a connection between that experience and the amount of good things versus bad things that we did. So the tally, the account balance of good mitzvahs versus I didn't do that mitzvah so well, and yes, I knew about that mitzvah and I still didn't do it, which is a bad thing. Versus, oh, I kind of sort of understood that mix, but I never really made the effort to find out, which is not such a bad thing, but still a bad thing. And I had no idea. No one was around to teach me. How can I be accountable for this? So on a scale of what is considered to be detrimental to your final reckoning.
This is not on the scale.
No.
It's a great scale you made. I like the scale, but it won't help you here. If let's say I'm a glutton, right? I'm a very big glutton. You can tell I am, right? I'm a glutton and I sit down and I make when I eat, this is not me, but theoretically, word me, I would eat, make a tremendous bracha beforehand. I would have this 2-foot hero sandwich, right, with all the cold cuts, and I would sit down and say, Baruch atah Hashem, et cetera, hamotzi lechem, you know, arutz, right? So now, what kind of an act is it? Is an act of mitzvah? What are you going to put? It's an act of a mitzvah. I bear tremendous bracha. It's an act of an avera because I was a glutton. What is it?
Where is the limit?
You see what I'm saying?
And then you become...
Let me answer. I have an answer. So in terms of, even if it's a mitzvah, because you made a tremendous bracha, when I see a hero sandwich, I've never actually had a super hero, but if I see a hero sandwich, so I'm going to make a tremendous, tremendous bracha with all the great kavanah, all the great intent in the world, so then theoretically, a person could always say, it's a great mitzvah I'm doing, right? You know, get off my back. Don't you see I'm doing a big mitzvah? But what we tell the guy is, you know what? You could be right now doing a mitzvah. And it could be right now, it's not a sin, it's not an avera. But, generally speaking, if you cultivate within yourself the drive for gluttony, then it will have negative repercussions. Perhaps not right now, but in other areas of your life, further down, in the way you relate to other people, all sorts of ramifications which it had, which are negative. So even though right now it's going to make you make a bracha with tremendous kavanah, we advise you not to do it in order not to have the negative ramifications. But it's advice. Rabbi comes to you and says, you're not allowed to eat your own sandwich, it's gluttony. Can't say that. He's going to make you a tremendous bracha. He's going to dance with tremendous kavanah afterwards, right? So how can you, but you can't say that in any way, shape, or form, you're doing something which is bad objectively, but subjectively it is. Because for you to eat this sandwich now develops in you a specific trait which you want to avoid. That's why midos are much more subtle than mitzvahs and averos.
So on that topic then, take one step further, are there halakhas on what is considered to be a baseline quantity for a meal? So that's an optional territory, right? But then again, if you take it too far, you could end up detracting from the purpose of the mitzvah, which is to be thankful so that you are accepting the baseline purpose of the mitzvah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is for your own well-being and also for the benefit.
Which mitzvah? Wait a minute, I think I found the traffic. Which mitzvah exactly?
Just in terms of making a meal. You have a meal and you're choosing the topic of gluttony. Okay, so you're eating way too much or whatever it is that's not necessary and doing it because of pleasure, but then you back it up with the intense desire and appreciation of the mitzvah by saying the bracha and doing the benching, right? So at what point does the territory of optional quantity become detrimental to firstly self and secondly to community? Because the whole purpose is for baseline.
So how am I supposed to answer you? For one guy it's the 6-inch hero, which is already too much. For another guy it's the 1-foot hero, which is too much, right? For another guy it's the 1.5-foot hero, which is too much, right?
So what about
maybe we could say that by the time you get to 2 feet, you're over the limit according to everybody. I don't know. But certainly within the parameters, each person is different.
He's asking another question. What about if you eat less in order to starve yourself?
Oh, is that what you're asking?
Because that may be the other extreme.
Yeah. Right, so that
what
also
about
depends.
That?
Interesting thing. That also depends because if you're eating less in order to starve yourself, that too, you know, at first it seems like a great thing because I'm trying to avoid gluttony. But if as a result I become a nasty, grumpy person and I resent Judaism because it's caused me all sorts of restrictions, that's not a good thing. My kid last night, my 8-year-old, after supper, we had pleasure supper, and then after supper he wanted to have a cup of, a powder of chocolate milk, right? It was come from a powder. So he didn't know it was milk. I wasn't going to tell him it was milk. But somebody else told him it was milk, and then I couldn't let him have it. So otherwise, I would have let him have it. I wouldn't have said anything. But it was very, very bad mood last night. So name it, so after he was told he couldn't have it, so he threw such a tantrum. I don't know, like a 20-minute tantrum.
Mm-hmm.
And merely said, you know, why is God so mean to us? Why can't he let us have, you know, the milkshake after the fleshshake, you know? What does he care? Right, so this is, you know, he's a big theologian, obviously,
wow.
8 years old.
It comes but, as a parent, because there you are, as a potential bearer, but then you try to cover it up with the tantrum, and you know that the kid's going to have a hard time, and what if he gets angry and chooses never to follow the
right, so that's why I wouldn't have told him. I wouldn't have told him. But now I told him, now somebody told him it was milkshake, so I had to take a stand. So the mindset, though, you know, whatever, what that indicates is that certain people, if you put too many restrictions on them, what this 8-year-old reflects is that certain people, if you put too many restrictions on them, they'll start resenting it. They'll start saying, you know, get off my back. I don't like being so restricted. And even if we're not as, you know, throw tantrums, you hopefully by the time we get older, we don't throw overt tantrums the same way, and we don't phrase necessarily our questions the same way that my son did. But nevertheless, that is a danger. If a person puts too many restrictions on himself, that he will then rebel. Gemara Yerushalmi says it. Yerushalmi says, you should, asay me avav, asay me yiro. You should do out of fear and you should do out of love. Right?
Yerushalmi says,
you should serve God out of fear and you should serve God out of love. And it says, you should serve God out of love because someone who loves does not come to hate. And you should serve God out of fear because someone who's fearful does not come to kick away. It's an interesting thing because it says, even if you love God and you decide, you know what, I'm going to restrain myself from eating this stuff because I love God and I want to do great things for God's purpose. So then eventually you might come to kate. Right? So you might say hate, I'm sorry. You might come to hate. That kind of love can sometimes lead to hate. That's why you have to be very careful that you don't end up in a situation where you're a tremendous volunteer and towards God, you know, diminishing the amount of food you eat and all that kind of stuff leads you to detect God for having made you go through all this. Which, of course, he would say to you, did I make you do this? You make yourself do it. But usually he doesn't speak of that directly.
But you're talking in terms of psychological consequences.
Mm-hmm.
What about in terms of physical consequences? The guy who, for instance, goes into gluttony may become a diabetic because mm-hmm. he's so fat that he is liable. Or the other way around, somebody who's starving himself may develop cardiac complications or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What about that implication?
Well, obviously, a person is not supposed to cause damage to his health. That's clearly the case. If you're going to those types of extremes, then it's also a psychological thing.
Yeah.
But the Torah never tells you to go to such extremes, and here you are going to extremes. You obviously have an obsessive compulsive personality, right? But the general idea is that you are not supposed to cause yourself harm, bodily harm. It's interesting, there's a famous Gemara, which not too many people are totally familiar with, even though people know a snippet of it. The Gemara in Baba Kama says that Rabbi Eliezer, one of the Tanaim, said that the reason a Nazir brings a sacrifice when he terminates the period of his Nazirus is because he's a sinner. Why is a sinner? Because he refrains from drinking wine. Right? That's what a Nazir has to do, is refrain from drinking wine. So he's called a sinner because he's curtailed his pleasure in this world and refrained from wine. Okay. So the Gemara says that that's one of the reasons it brings a korban. Now, people make the mistake whenever they learn this, many people make the mistake when they learn this one, as I did for many years, to think, wow, a nazir is a negative thing. But it's bad to be a nazir. A nazir is called a sinner, right, because he's deprived himself of wine. But that's a misunderstanding what Rabbi Eliezer is saying. So it's not that we hold like Rabbi Eliezer, it was just his specific perspective, but he doesn't mean a person shouldn't become a nazir. When a person becomes a nazir, he achieves all sorts of, if he does it for the right reasons, he achieves all sorts of great heights of sanctity, right? The Rambam says that nazirus become a nazir is a stepping stone on the way to prophecy. But there is one aspect of it in depriving oneself, which is negative. So therefore, yes, deprivation is a negative thing. But if it's within, even to deprive oneself of wine, it's a negative thing. But nevertheless, sometimes it's indicated it's a good thing to do, for whatever reason. And when it's a good thing to do, so even though it has a negative aspect to it, the totality of the thing is a good thing. So now, again, in your case, if it goes to an extreme, obviously, not to deprive oneself of wine, you know, it might be a little bit, feel deprivation, but it's not going to hurt his health, right? So therefore, at least not in a significant way. So therefore, that's okay. And then we say, you know, even though you're doing something which is negative, but it's overwhelmed by the positive. But if a person, the Torah never gives us a mitzvah which actually requires a person to deprive himself in a way which is harmful for himself, because that is not something which we would require or even advise, or perhaps maybe would say, we might even say that's forbidden. Okay, but that's an extreme. Yeah.
This question is definitely not the answer here, but I'm asking because it's on my mind. I could write it down, but it has a connection to the class that we were in the other night. When you talked about briefly in the war situations, when a soldier goes to war,
mm-hmm.
and there's certain things that are not necessarily judged in the same light because they're there for a totally different purpose rather than just being a general citizen. Right, they could be a general citizen.
They're a different frame of mind.
But they're under a different frame of mind, and more specifically, they're under the command and control of an entire plan, which is beyond themselves to achieve a certain purpose. Couldn't you make the same argument in that case for people that submit themselves to a certain community of hierarchy or leadership? I'm not there for myself. I'm there and following these rules because someone else is in control. And that we're all trying to achieve a greater purpose there. And
let me see if I understand what you're saying. I'm not sure.
Therefore, I shouldn't be held accountable for this mitzvah, for that mitzvah, for...
I thought you were saying something else. Yeah. But I thought you were coming on to your deprivation thing again. I thought you were saying, well, what happens if somebody decides to join, let's say, a kibbutz? And obviously he's going to deprive himself. In the old days when kibbutzim were required sacrifice, now they don't anymore. But so let's say that so was he allowed to sacrifice certain things for himself in order to join this group which he feels is going to cause his life to be more beneficial for him, or more advantageous for him, or greater, better for him in the long run? The answer is, of course, yes. You can actually, if you want to join a group of people who are limiting themselves in certain ways, so, you know, go ahead and join them. But that's not what you're really asking. You're asking whether when you're a member of this group, are you less culpable for the things that you do wrong if they are part and parcel of the group's mode of behavior, not your individual behavior.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
So the answer is yes, but so what?
It must be relevant, because I might be doing the same thing and getting the same amount of pleasure out of it as an individual, but hey, now I'm going to do it within a group as an institution, and therefore I'm less culpable, so surely that's going to have a difference in merit. In
very little. I'll give you an example. Actually, Rav Noah Weinberg is an example. He says that we know that if a person worships Avodah Zarah, he's an idolater as an individual person. So the penalty for that is stoning. What happens if a person is part of society which serves Avodah Zarah, specifically what's called an Ir Hanidah, a city which was, you know, pushed off and which was persuaded by missionaries to serve Avodah Zarah?
Let's give an example in modern
day terms.
You love certain football.
No, I have to do it in modern age of them. I'll let you bring mine in a minute, but I have a reason for this. So the the penalty for any da'as is that they are all put to death by sword. They're all killed, all the people who worship Avodah Zarah. According to the Rambam, a very, very difficult Rambam. It seems Rambam holds that even the people who didn't worship Avodah Zarah put to death, it's very hard to sustain that. We assume that the Rambam didn't mean it. But and they put them to death by sword, and you have to destroy their property. The individual who served Avodah Zarah, you don't destroy his property. The city who served Avodah Zarah, you have to destroy their property. So it says Rabbi Weinberg, look, the penalty of sword, the killing by sword, is less severe than the penalty of killing by stoning. So we see that if somebody is part of society which sins, so his culpability is diminished. Now I said not by much. I said so what? Because in the end you're going to get killed anyway. But that we're going to give you a somewhat more pleasant death if you were part of a society that sins as opposed to being an individual who sins. On the other end, though, he said, the reason why by an individual the money gets to be retained by the family or whoever, whereas by the community, well, everything, all the possessions have to be burnt, is because the impact of a communal sin is far worse than the impact of an individual sin. So on the person who participated in the sin, the culpability for a communal sin is less. But the impact on the environment or on the the town or whatever the case may be is worse in the case of communal sin than an individual sin.
The golden calf. If one guy walks his own little golden calf versus the whole community of his 2,000 have done it. Compare those two in the example.
Same idea. If a person did it, one person built a golden calf, so he would be much more liable for his personal choice than if he was part of society which was persuaded to worship a golden calf. On the other hand, if there's a society which worships a golden calf in unison, then the tumah, the desecration, the defilement, which is generating the world as a result, is much greater than if a specific individual did it.
So there's an inverse correlation between the amount of tumah that is occurring and the number of people that are participating in a certain act. So the more people, the greater the tumah, the less the individual culpability, and vice versa. The less the tumah, the greater the individual culpability, the smaller the community. So it's a tri-correlation.
Yeah. And also it comes from penalty. As you said, penalty for an individual is stoning, and for a community is sword. So you want to try the monastery prison? Go ahead.
Okay. So, football. American football. Any game, any sporting event is similar to a gladiators contest,
right,
which is not necessarily a good thing for the community.
Right.
It rouses certain interests, ideas, competitiveness, which is not to the benefit of the community in the same way that learning a story together would be. So So therefore, that is considered to be a non-welcome activity. You could make other arguments for it in a bunch of other ways. People get hurt overall, there's certain emotions, heightened spirits, etc., etc., etc. Any example of a football situation where people are flocking to the game versus those that don't want to go for whatever reason they choose not to go, excluding the fact that they're just not interested in football, because then that would exclude them from the test.
Right.
In order to participate in this test example, they have to be interested football goers that are either abstaining or not abstaining as they would from a glass of wine. I choose to drink the wine or I don't choose to drink the wine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so using a football example again, because it has the greatest coverage in terms of understanding from country to country, you know, different levels of education. Now we've got this trifold correlation of a group versus an individual versus the level of tamai and the level of culpability. Okay? So even before four issues. So a person decides, I want to go to a football game, and I don't care what anybody else thinks. I'm not taking my friends with me. I'm not going to encourage other people to come with me. I'm certainly not going to go there and root anybody on. I'm just going to be there, be quiet, not talk to anyone, and like just enjoy the game. Hell, I watch it on TV, okay, which is a whole other avail on its own.
Yeah.
Versus somebody that is so into the game that they put on their shirt and they want to be a part of the group, and they take a pool in the office, and they decide to take bets before the game, and they watch all the commercials and the plays, you know, this play and that play, and I saw the game in 1955 when, you know, this game, and they're so into the game that their life is consumed by the game of this football event, and they go to the event, and now they're a part of the community, they're loud and proud about it, they talk to everybody, they take the signature. Anyway, I think we get the point. That person is now participating in a golden calf as a community versus those who are participating in the game or the golden calf as an individual.
Correct.
Okay? So now we apply the tamai and the culpability. So the level of tamai of a football game would be a lot greater to the community if they continue to participate in the game as a community. However, the culpability of the individual that is going to the game with that intention is not necessarily being as big a deal as it would be if the person had to go to the game on their own without anybody else's knowledge, very secretively. I'm going to enjoy this game. I'm watching it on TV in my room when I should be doing a whole bunch of other things, and I'm antisocial with it, and I'm not doing anything else, and this is my focus, my interest, and it's a secret.
So he's more culpable.
More culpability,
right.
Let tamai to the overall group.
Yeah, that's true.
And vice versa.
Absolutely.
So that, yeah, I mean, I wish I said it in less words, but is that a
connection? It's very good, very succinct, actually. The question, now that you said, oh, do you agree?
Do I agree?
Yeah.
Absolutely. You're the rabbi. I don't want to disagree with the rabbi. If it's the same thing, then...
You cop out. Right? So passionate about disagreeing with the rabbi. So, yeah, I think that's the idea. The idea is clearly that the group diminishes the person's individual responsibility, but it could cause a more pervasive defilement. So, but again, you know, it's an interesting case you bring up, football. Football is one of these things where somebody can make the argument, although football is just a little bit difficult to make the argument, but let's say baseball, right? So some people make the argument that, you know, baseball is absolutely forbidden to be a baseball fan, right? Because you're wasting your time on something which is completely irrelevant and something which is frivolous, right? Yet, nevertheless, you know, there are many people who do go to baseball games. Obviously, they feel that they need some sort of outlet for their, you know, to write for emotions, to chill out, so to speak, or to have a good time, so they go to baseball games. So, is it absolutely forbidden to go to a baseball game? No, definitely not. Now, the question is, it's not absolutely forbidden whether you draw the line. So this is a very hard thing to know how to do. Some people who draw the line and say, no baseball. Some people draw the line and say, well, some baseball. Some people draw the line and say, well, not season tickets. Some people draw the line and say, well, not the World Series. You know, everybody has, and each person may well have a legitimate perspective on what they need, or they may be fooling themselves.
What if you created your own sport that was a version of baseball that nobody else played, and now you were trying to like start a whole new thing, a new sport, and you're being creative, but you're going against the norms of what people are usually enjoying?
What's the question?
Question is, at what point does creativity within a concept that could potentially be tamai, that might be magnified by the number of people that participate in it, is that creativity considered lawful or unlawful within the halakha?
It's a gray area. It's a gray area. I don't know, if you're making a new sport because, you know, you want people to be entertained and find themselves happier, so to speak, as a result, then maybe it's a good thing. If you're making a new sport because you want people to come gamble and you want to make money off their bets, so then it's probably a bad thing. I mean, it's hard to know where exactly to draw the line.
I'll tell you an interesting situation I was in. I was taking a course in Tinek, and one of these guys who is probably young, very religious, so there's a conflict in terms of interpretation between Momzi and Tinek. What's the difference? Whether they should, are they allowed to play tennis on Shabbos?
Yeah. In Monty, we play tennis on Shabbos, right?
I don't remember exactly what he said. One community was not allowed, and the other one was tolerated.
They play tennis on Shabbos. Yeah.
They do.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. That's an interesting thing. You know, in the modern Orthodox community like Tinek, what people do on Shabbos afternoon is they're going to put on their shorts and their sneakers, and they go play basketball or they go play tennis, right? Because that's their, so to speak, Shabbos rest. So, you know, I would say that that's, you know, forbidden. But obviously, their rabbis don't go and protest it. And it could be because the rabbis prefer play, they'll lose a job. They protest
maybe
it.
Maybe they'll lose their community.
They lose the community. Sure. But on the other hand, you know, it could be that somebody could construe, I can't see how, but somebody can construe the argument that this is how actually a legitimate way to observe Shabbos.
Maybe they'll have to go back to yeshiva, the rabbis that is, spend more time studying to prove why it's not a good idea.
Yeah, but isn't that, again, that what you were talking before, a question of interpretation?
Yeah, it's just that
a certain tolerance.
Yes, it's just that I hold that this is close to objectively no good.
Okay.
If not, maybe not exactly objectively, you know, but there are different types of subjectivity. You know, there's objective, absolutely objective, then something which is somewhat objective, something which is more subjective, and so on and so forth. This I hold is this much next to objective. It's very hard to...
much more to the borderline.
Right, much more to the borderline. It seems, at least to the naked eye, is something which is the antithesis of the atmosphere of Shabbos. Okay? So that's the story with pleasure. Now, we go on to laughter. Hachav Dal is a new spoke. We have to limit your laughter. The eighth result, so it says in the Maral, we can ask, I will also allow close people, Olam Hazeh, you're not allowed to fill your mouth with laughter in this world. Why? Because the Beis HaMikdash is not standing. Okay, the Omar, the Kirito, like it says, the parents ate Omdin in Mesef the Brachos. Omar, the Yochum, Mishum, Rabbi Shimba, Yochai, the Yochum, the name of Rabbi Shimba, Yochai, also allow close people, Olam Hazeh, you can't fill your mouth with laughter in this world. Shinam, as it says, on, then, in the future, Yimoli is close people, our mouths will be full of laughter. So, in other words, it seems to be the way the morale is taken in the question is that from there it means you're not supposed to laugh at all, you're supposed to walk around and be glum and miserable. Not quite, but, you know, something along those lines. So it says the morale, basically, this is not difficult. Now, to fill your mouth with laughter, really large and enthusiastic laughter, that would be forbidden. Okay? I was close to Alma. But in terms of general laughter, there's no prohibition. In other words, to really get what we say in English, a rangatum, fully immersed in your laughter, that's very bad. Because that goes against the commemoration of Yerushalayim being destroyed.
Is this the source of the typical profile of the evil, you know, count? Ha 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 ha! You know,
yeah, the deep belly laugh is considered to be a very non-Jewish thing. Right, exactly.
Is that the source of it?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, Now, I don't know exactly what he means, because before he said mute doesn't mean completely to remove it, but here he says in terms of learning Torah, you have to completely remove your rapture. A little bit strange, because before he said it's not completely, and here it is completely. So he's going to explain. Things will work out. Anyway, it's not difficult. Let's say it's completely forbidden to have to laugh. We come along, Ashma Inon, nevertheless, is telling us on a different level. Not just that it's not favor to laugh. Let's say it's prohibited. But besides that, laughter is an inhibiting factor. It's a detriment to acquiring further. Why is that? Because very great laughter, who has a chanam shava, is the opposite of thought. Shuasecha, which is in the mind. That's why laughter cancels or negates the mind. It's an interesting idea. I don't know, it would seem that there are many sitcoms in modern times which require a great deal of, wisdom or actually not brilliance or creativity in order to write. But nevertheless, the Maharal is postulating that laughter in and of itself, being an emotional response and being a response which is somewhat uncontrollable and also being a response which is completely physical, they all go in opposition to brain work. Brain work is serious work. A person whose brain is working, so now it's grinding away. It's not open, it's not susceptible to laughing matters. Right? It's no laughing matter. So that is actually what the Maharal is saying, that if somebody is too engaged in laughter, too immersed in that, then his brain can't function properly.
What if it's the other way around?
It was. He's too immersed in that. Oh, that's what he's going to say. So, the Dover is at two kol ha'avim. So in this you can understand. He has kol mishadesh. Look at this amazing, amazing thing. The almost the end of the page. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 7 lines up from the end of the paragraph. Not the set meal. Laughter, mitchadesh, comes about, meaning yisul, from poking fun, and leisanus, and mockery, bilvad, only. It's an amazing statement. It says, laughter comes about because of mockery and poking fun. Mm-hmm. So therefore, mockery, scoffing, and poking fun, leads the person to be cynical, and leads the person actually to not be receptive to learning new things. He makes a mockery of everything. So a person who laughs a lot, usually that laugh is because things are being mocked, or things are being made fun of. So therefore the laughter is the antithesis of being smart, or being, adopting wisdom. This is generally a major problem. Of course, the person is too cynical, and too much of a scoffer, and he laughs at everything, and doesn't find anything to have value, so then of course, what's he ever going to learn? It's not valuable for him. He's not going to do anything about it. But the Maharal says that's why laughter per se is not a good thing. That's what he says. On the Reader's Digest, they have a column, laughter is the best medicine. So I don't know exactly what the Maharal would do with that statement. Imagine the Maharal would not necessarily agree with it. But when the Reader's Digest says laughter is the best medicine, they mean harmless jokes. If there is such a thing. It's hard to say because most jokes do in fact poke fun at somebody. But theoretically, I guess you could say that there are jokes that just are funny without poking fun. But the Maharal would say that the problem with laughter is not so much that you're laughing, the physical activity of laughing, but rather the mockery and poking fun which is behind it. The answer is there's no question. Kiyahisu, then mockery, who has a chasecha, is the opposite of wisdom. Kiyahisu, udavar, because scoffing is something she'eba mamish. There's no substance to it. By definition, the person who scoffs, he scoffs because he doesn't possess something. He might even be jealous that he doesn't possess something, and therefore he mocks it, right? Like the famous perspective.
But if he didn't mock it and you used it as a motivating factor, it might drive him to spend
more time
trying to achieve it.
Absolutely, that's true. Right. But usually when he laughs at it, then he laughs it off. That's
it's
a difference.
Like, oh, not
yeah.
good enough for me.
Right.
It's, I don't need to know how to
there's
do that.
A famous dictum, which is that everybody to my left is not observant enough, and everybody to my right is too observant. And the only person who's perfect is me, right? Most people, whether they consciously think that way or subconsciously think that
way.
Where's the balance in this room?
Where's the balance in this
room? You have to find your own.
So obviously that's the scoffer's perspective. In other words, there's nothing for me to learn from those who are, you know, to my right because they're too frum. There's nothing for me to learn from those who are to my left because they're too fried, too not frum. Right, so therefore the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos earlier that we call Malam Dayis Galti. I learned something from everybody. Or rather, I derived intelligence from anybody who tried to teach me. Because from every person, you can derive something. If you're not going to scoff. If you're not going to be cynical, then you can derive from every person.
Right.
Most people are not like that. So therefore, since they scoff and they mock and they regard themselves as being perfect, or close to perfect, so therefore they look at other people in a negative way, and they can't learn anything as a result. Most of the person has to offer, you're not going to learn if you hold that person in low esteem. That's the way it is, right? And then he says a very important thing to my mom. The last line of the start, the last two lines, he says, the ain has quite doyme el simcha. Simcha is good. Chok is bad. Isn't that interesting? It's good to be happy. It's not good to laugh.
So he's making a distinction between happiness and laughter.
Exactly, right. So then I think the one time a year that laughter is considered good is, can you guess when?
It's even a story.
No. Close.
Shabbos.
No. Getting further away.
Purim.
Right. Purim says that the reason why that is because one is not allowed to scoff at anything except for idolatry. Right? And scoffing at idolatry...
Also Mordecai.
Which Mordecai did.
I'm talking about Uman,
which is the same thing, right, exactly. Haman was represented in idolatry. He was wearing like a little image on his chest, which everybody's supposed to bow down to. So you're allowed to make a mockery out of something which is antithetical to Torah, right? Of anything which has the slightest capacity of being Torah, you're not allowed to make a mockery. But of things which are completely removed from Torah, then you can make a mockery, and that was By Purim specifically, in this battle with Haman, we make all sorts of, you know, comedies, mocking stories, and so on and so forth.
Are
but
you
the rest of the time,
to
minutes.
Make a mockery, or you're encouraged to make?
On Purim?
Yeah.
But you see, I think I didn't make the mistake. I don't think I made a mistake when I said things are story. It's because it's joy. It's having fun out of joy.
Mm-hmm.
But in Purim, when you say it's more in terms of what the Maharal says, out of some hand.
Right. Okay. That's true.
So you're allowed to have
fun
when you're enjoying something.
Right.
But not when you're contemptuous.
Right. I like the word contemptuous. I should have thought that word before. So it says, happiness, you don't have to laugh to be happy. You know, you're supposed to smile, but you don't have to laugh. Right? So laughing is... Chok is not just internal, could be internal too, but it's also external. So simcha, an external sense of well-being or happiness or contentment, very important, right? But chok, which is an outward thing, it's almost like a buffer between you and accomplishing more study, more wisdom, more knowledge. So therefore, that chok is bad, even though simcha is good.
Look at this one. In Argentina, you know, there are a lot of Nazis, and there was one group that was very strong, extremely Nazi, and they were very, very heavily armed with explosives. So when Perón was overthrown, the army came and said, you either give in or we blow you up. The guy said, we are not giving in. So they went and blew them up. Everybody was joyous.
He is talking about contempt. I'm glad it happened to you.
It could have happened to
Yeah, oh, that might be okay, but you know, even when you see somebody slip on a banana peel, right, the classic
right.
So something, you know, with the fact that you laugh.
But that's not a banana peel.
Right, so you laugh in that situation because it's blue, but it's mean spirited, right?
Even though it's an omen. Again, you know, that's the Chinese royal.
What?
Those guys who were killed. Yeah. By the military.
We're Sony as well.
We're going to see a Sony as
no, I understand, right? That's a common, right? No, I agree, but I'm just saying that. But what's
about the recent
No, no, that was 40 years ago.
But, it's, but the point is, what the Maharal is saying is then is not that scenario. So that when you see somebody slip on a banana peel, your friend, and you start giggling, so that's like, you know, a mockery, scoffing,
or
enjoying
somebody
else.
Somebody who is the leader of Hamas, right?
Right. Of course, there's something else.
And, you know, you get killed. Are you going to feel sorry for him? Absolutely not.
So everything is relative. You're
grabbing
that. I would love to have a discussion. If there is any commentary, I'm sure there must be either Maharal or it must be Maharal because it's Derek Hunt, right? Maharal's commentary on Derek Hunt on atavistic traits. The traits that we experience, you know, you're driving past the accident, seeing them a crime, seeing them an accident, you see people. It's destruction, it's blood, and why do we look? Why do we have to look? We know it's going to be there. Why? I mean, that animal inside us that has to see, that has to...
It's a good question. I don't know where I'm going to find it. I'll have to think about it.
Now we have
it. It gave me a challenge. Okay, we'll stop here.
You can continue tomorrow, right?
Tomorrow, Kenny, yeah. Monday, Tuesday, I'm not going to be here. Sunday, Monday, I'm not going to be here, but I... I think the office will get us up. We're in Seattle for a wedding.
Whole family?
What? Whole family. My wife's cousin. Knock
yeah.
And out.
Yeah. No choice.
Yeah.
Get ready.
Yeah.
That's not the kids are coming. That's not the
coming. No choice. Same gray
hair. Right. My family would have a choice.
Right.
You're working on those. Nothing to say about it.
He's not afraid
to tell you what's going on. You see, if you know what
he's not a phony.
No.
He tells me
he has
this.
I hope I didn't take all the time.
No, that's right. He likes this type of discussion because he likes to be on his toes.